If you're not married, then it may be that that's your calling. The Apostle Paul wasn't married. But that's not the calling of the majority of people. You're special in that respect. And tonight we're going to be talking to the singles as well as to the married. But mainly we'll be talking to those who are married in an attempt to show some of the real deeper meanings of what it means to become one. And I've got a surprise for you. It was a surprise to me about last week out in Hobbs, New Mexico. This thing occurred to me. I'd been preaching it for some years in a different vein. And all of a sudden, I became aware of the fact that this applies to marriage. So I'll be looking forward to sharing that with you tonight. If you've been here Friday and Saturday night and at the class this morning, you know many of the things that have been said, and we want to project it a bit further now as we talk about the erosion of a marriage. Let me read you some things and make an observation as far as history is concerned. In the Greek and Roman and Jewish world, at the time of the Lord, the time that Christ lived, marriages ended abruptly, without any provocation and without any justification often, in fact, most of the times. You'd just wake up one morning and you'd be out of a home, or you'd just have been separated and divorced from your husband or your wife and you didn't know anything about it. And listen to this, if you will. Let me find it here. When Roman matrons, and that is when the wives, the Roman wives, became the equal and voluntary companions of their lord, in other words, whenever ERA had made its final impact, that's what it said. They had an ERA movement back there, and they need one up to a point, you know. But anyway, whenever Roman matrons became the equal and voluntary companions of their lords, a new jurisprudence was introduced that marriage, like other partnerships, might be dissolved by the benediction of one of the associates. In 3 centuries of prosperity and corruption, this principle was enlarged to frequent practice and pernicious abuse. Passion, interest, or caprice suggested daily motives for the dissolution of marriage. A word, a sign, a message, a letter, the mandate of a freed man declared the separation. The most tender of human connections was degraded to a transient society of profit or pleasure. And that's from Edward Gibbon, the agnostic or the atheist, the infidel. He wasn't a Christian. But he saw in the Roman society and recorded what he saw. But you know what? We're standing there today. We're not looking at that situation in prospect. We're looking at it as it is all around us. In America today, the likelihood of your marriage failing, if it's left up to the normal average of the nation, is 1 in 2. That's the trend to which we are moving. And there's enough evidence to indicate that that's exactly where we practically are. 1 marriage out of 2 failing. And I have some statistics in my mind that I'll try to recall. In 1960, there were recorded 400,000 divorces in that year. 1 decade later, in 1971, the number was 768,000, almost double the number in 71 as they were in 1960. Now, that doesn't mean that was the accumulation of it. It meant that in that year, 1971, there were 768,000 divorces, where in 1960, 11 years earlier, there had been 400,000 that year. And then in 1965, it climbed on up to about 800,000. And then in 1966, it passed 1 million. And they're estimating that in 1977, when the figures are all in for this year, that we will record over 1.5 million divorces in this year in which we're living. And the statistics are frightening, that the prospects before us are certainly, they're just unbelievable. How many homes will be broken up and destroyed by 1980? Well, I just don't know, but the indications are that we're in for a real battering. So we better batten down the hatches and tie everything down. We're coming up against some times that within the next 10 years, you're going to see some erosion and some dissolutions and some change of social patterns that will startle you and make you wonder if it's even wise to have any children to grow up in that kind of a society. Well, the things that I have mentioned here, let me make one or two other quotations. By the second century B.C., marriage was becoming unpopular in high social circles, and divorce was becoming common. There was no difficulty in the operation of divorce. It was purely a private matter, and either party could send the other a notice of it without any given reason. That's no-fault divorce we were talking about. They had it 200 B.C. We're not so new. And either one could send the other a notice of it without any given reason or any complaint of misconduct. You know, you just got tired of looking at her. In fact, Ben Cyrus says, if she go not as you'd have her go, cut her off from your flesh. What's the problem? Just divorce her. And that's where they were back there. Listen to this statement. This is from Josephus. He has his foot in his mouth, but you can understand him anyway. He that desires to be divorced from his wife for any cause whatsoever, and many such causes happen among men, let him give her in writing assurance that he'll never use her as his wife again. And he stated it exactly like he thought. Never let him use her. Because that's about all they did with women back there. They just used them. Put them off. Sent her a note. Gave a message to a slave and says, take this down there to Priscilla. She's at the second door on the right. Take it down there and just tell her I don't want to see her anymore. The Jewish word for the divorce decree was gittin, G-I-T-T-I-N. Now, that's purely coincidental. But that's the word, that's the way you pronounce the Hebrew word for the divorce decree, get. G-I-T, it was called the gittin. Well, we can see that we're not far from that today. And what you plan to do with it, you're going to have to make a decision because it involves you and me. I really am not concerned this morning about statistics of what's happening around the nation. That involves us and it concerns us. And I'm really not all that concerned, though, at the same time about the statistics about how many marriages are breaking up. That's frightening. But, you know, all we can do is what we can do right around where we are. And what I'm really concerned about is not what's causing marriages to break up. What I want us to see is what causes them to break down. If we can learn what's causing them to break down, then we'll be well on our way toward stopping them from breaking up. And the statements that are made here that I've just read are examples of the abuse to which marriage was subjected in the days of the Lord, and it is an indication of the prevalence and the often occurrence of divorce in that corrupt society. And it's increasingly true today among our own people, among our own, not only in the world, but in the church as well. At the first service, I apologized to the young people. I apologized on behalf of all of us older people who have failed these younger people in the younger generation because of the example that we have failed to set of a good marriage. And let me just say very briefly to you young people who are not yet married, let me apologize to you, please, for the failure to set the kind of example that we should have set before you. For the failure to have amended our ways, for the failure to have spoken on these subjects maybe 25 years ago, we apologize. And for whatever we have done that contributed to the instability of the home, to the instability of the social patterns into which you're moving as a growing up adult, let us apologize and say, please forgive us. It's increasingly true in our day that the marriages of our age are very unstable. They're not going to make it, and as we've already quoted the statistics, it shows that, and we're on our way to a very disconcerting and upsetting time in society. But I'm not really directing our attention to that today. I want to direct our attention this morning to a more subtle form of putting us under a marriage. I want to put before us today something of which all of us, in one degree or another, and in one way or another, are guilty. Because we're going to be talking about marriage today and the dissolution of it, not at the divorce decree level. We're going to be talking about it at the attitudes and the building block level. That's where it's important. Someone said, and you know, General Douglas MacArthur, when he was leaving his post of duty, President Truman had relieved him of his command. The combined House of the senators and the House of Representatives was called, and this great old soldier stood there, and the last remark that he made, in a sense, to the nation, was that old soldiers never die. They just fade away. I'd like to take off on that and just say that old marriages never die. They just erode away. You know, marriages, once they get past a certain point, you can't really say that they just, you know, was chopped off one day. You don't know where it started. They just kind of eroded away. That's what's so sad. One day over in New Zealand, I was talking to this young man, and I don't know how the subject came up, but I asked him about it, him and his wife, and how they were doing. And he said, oh, well, he said, we're kind of at the chalk and cheese stage. And I never had heard that expression before. Have any of you ever heard of the chalk and cheese stage? I never had. But even though I didn't exactly know what it meant, I got the impression that it wasn't all that good. Chalk, you know, it's not all that tasty. In fact, I don't know of anything that could be less tasty, less appetizing than chalk. And maybe that's what he was saying about his wife. She's just not all that appetizing anymore. And cheese, well, it'll mold after it gets so old. And maybe he was just saying that their marriage was kind of tasteless, and when you get right down to it, it's kind of moldy. I don't know. But I do know this, that marriages can get stagnant. They need to be revitalized. They need to be re-enlivened. And occasionally, and if not regularly and periodically, they need to have a shot of adrenaline. They need to have a review. They need to have a recommitment. And all of us here today, one time or other in our lives, and continually from this point on in our marriages, we're going to have to revitalize, review, do anything else that says we're going to shuffle this thing around and we're going to revise it and we're going to revive it. We're going to have to do this if we have marriages that are rewarding, so that at the end of our lives we can be like the old gentleman whose letter I read last night, as he talked about how they had lived together so long they'd come to be like each other, and with greater and greater love they were nearing the end of their journey, and he wrote that beautiful letter to his wife when she was 76 years old and he was about 85. And I'll tell you, we're going to have to do the same thing if we have marriages the same way. Now, many times couples find themselves locked into what they feel like is a hopeless situation. And if you're married to someone where you see no improvement being made, that's one of the most frustrating things in the world, is to realize, have mercy, I'm locked in with this thing. I've been married to her for 5 years or 10 years or 15, and I see no improvement whatsoever. She's still the most obnoxious, she's catty, she's loud, she's cantankerous, she's sullen, she's selfish, or the he, you can put the he just in there just as well, and you think, man alive, what in the world am I going to do? And a lot of people find their marriages just crumbling and the foundation just eroding away. You can't just notice it every day, just exactly what's happening, but all of a sudden you begin to see some lines and some fissures forming and some gullies, and finally, there just isn't anything left. And after about 5 or 10 years, or maybe 15, or sometimes 25 years, you look around for that upon which your marriage is resting, and it's not resting on anything. And as one woman told me one time regarding her and her husband, she said, I looked at him one day and I found out that he was sitting right there in front of her. She said, we didn't have one single thing in common. Ooh, I thought, my goodness, lady. They had 4 children, but she said, other than the 4 children, we don't have a single thing in common between us. Now, that's what I'm referring to this morning. That's what I want us to look at. Look, first of all, at the foundation of the marriage that we've already mentioned. The foundation of marriage is found in Matthew, the 19th chapter, and in Mark, where you read this morning. That was a beautiful choice of scriptures. I couldn't have done better if I'd done it myself. Taking us back to the very original statement in Genesis 2, and then the reference in Mark, and this one in Matthew is a parallel to that one in Mark. And then he says here in Matthew, these 4 or 5 things are the basis of our marriages. Listen, in Matthew 19, 3 through 6, and if you want to turn to it, you can, but you may be familiar enough with it by now that you don't have to, but I'll wait on you. Matthew 19, 3 through 6, he informs us there of the original design that God intended regarding marriage. Notice once it is distinctive in its origin as an institution, that it was made that way by God. He says, don't you know that he who made them from the beginning, made them male and female, he who made them from the beginning shows that there is a distinctiveness in the marriage institution itself. It originated with God. There's also a distinctive identity of the parties involved. He made them male and female. And we noticed this morning how thankful we were that males aren't like females. We noticed it the other night and got some amen from the men. And I know that's exactly, boy, I'm so glad that women aren't like men. I'm so glad that my wife is not like me. Bony. I've got knotty knees. I've got a hammer toe. She's got the most beautiful feet of any mortal I've ever seen. You know, people don't usually have pretty feet. She's got lovely feet. I don't know what I fell in love with her feet before I saw her. She's just beautiful. From the feet up, she's pretty. But her feet are beautiful. How'd they get off on that? Where am I? Oh, yeah, women and men are different. Women and men are so different. I'm so glad that she's soft. I'm glad she hadn't got hair all over her body like men have. I'm glad she hadn't got hair on her chest. Aren't you glad that your wife doesn't have hair on her chest? Aren't you glad that she doesn't shave every morning? You know, get over, I've got to shave. Aren't you glad that that's not like that? Aren't you glad that she has lovely hair? Aren't you glad that she's soft and tender to the touch? Aren't you glad that she can bear children? Amen. Aren't you glad you didn't have to have the children? I'll tell you what, if you had had to have the children, man, there wouldn't be one child in each family. Just one. Yeah, the human race would stop because there wouldn't be but one. You'd have your tubes tied immediately. Sure. Aren't you glad that she was the one that bears the children? Aren't you glad that she's the one that has the monthly cycle? Yeah. Oh, I'm so thankful for that. I'm glad I don't have to go through that. There was a man at one of the military academies in Bellbuckle that told his boys once in a class, he said, listen, men, you be dead thankful that you have to shave every morning rather than go through what the woman has to go through every month. He said, you be thankful that you have to shave. And you know, there's a lot of sense in that. Oh, aren't you glad that your wife has the ability to nourish and nurse a child? There's nothing more beautiful on earth than a nursing mother. In fact, I think that a pregnant woman is the most beautiful thing on earth. I don't know of a time when a woman is more beautiful than when she's pregnant. Really. Something about her happens. It's the difference between a ripe and a green apple. There's not much all that much about a green apple hanging there, but you let that thing start filling out and just about ready to drop, why, there's something beautiful about it you can't describe. A woman is like that. I tell my wife, I say, honey, you're prettier to me when you're pregnant than at any other time in your life. Finally, get to, and I better not say that anyway, but it's just tremendous. Well, I'm glad that women are like that. I'm glad that men are different, and we ought to recognize those differences. Well, there's that distinct identity of the parties. There's the distinctive role assigned, though the only reference to it is here where it says that for this cause a man shall leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife. That just simply means that it's the man's initiative. He's the one that's to get it started and keep it going, like we mentioned last night. He's the one who has to take the initiative, and he's to leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife. There's a distinctive result. Oneness is the result. Jesus said, for this cause, they shall no longer be two, but one. They shall become one. Listen to this statement by this man, Lloyd Ogilvie. He says, marriage is for oneness. Loving, expressed, and giving. A great Christian marriage is the unrestricted giving of mind, emotion, body, will, and soul to a mate as if given to Christ. A marriage is most Christian not when it's free of problems and difficulties, but when two persons open themselves to the Spirit of Christ, surrender their wills to Him, commit their living to Him, and as a conscious dedication seek to love each other and give themselves to each other as they have been loved and given to by Christ. This is more than making Christ the head of the home. It is the daily, hourly, moment-by-moment willingness to see Christ in our mates and to serve, love, and honor Him by what we say, do, give, and forgive. Only in this way can differences of personality be blended, the uniqueness of each one affirmed, the defensiveness of our own rights be healed, and the hurts done to us be forgiven. Marriage is for oneness. That's what it's all about. And it means oneness in the sense that as God means oneness. Oneness for God, his mathematics is not all that, it doesn't meet our standards. His mathematics say 1 + 1 + 1 = 1. A husband and a wife and the Lord, these three are the component parts of a successful Christian marriage. A successful Christian marriage consists of God at the top and the husband and the wife in a triangle. It's a triad arrangement. And unless you've got that triangular arrangement, you don't really have the completeness of oneness that God designed marriage to be where Christians are involved. 1 + 1 + 1 = 1. And Jesus says, what God has made one, let no man put asunder. Don't destroy that at all. Now, let me say again, what I'm talking about this morning is not at the divorce decree level. We're not talking about somebody who's gone down to the courthouse and obtained a divorce decree. That's not, we're not talking about that. We're talking about back this side of that, maybe 10 years or 5 years or 20 years back beside that, this side of that decree, to where the internal seeds of destruction and the internal seeds of erosion have been planted consciously or subconsciously or unconsciously, but subtly or openly. Where these seeds have been planted that have caused the marriage just to erode and to waste away and to wash away and dwindle away into nothing. What is that? Listen to this, if you will, another quote from this man. What are the internal seeds of destruction in a couple's own relationship which put asunder what God has joined together? This forces us to consider the dehumanizing and debilitating attitudes, patterns, and traits with which we negate or nullify the oneness which God wants to give. Bartered love, you know what bartered love is? To barter means that I'll exchange, I've got apples and you've got plums. We'll just barter back and... Bartered love means I'll give you this if you give me that. Women are good at this. I'll give you sex if you'll give me, this, that, and the other. Or men are good at it. I'll give you money if you'll give me this. And we'll keep the thing on even keel by bartering and we'll trade back and forth. You'd be surprised how many people spend their married life bartering love. Don't do that. Bartered love, hidden agendas, all these hidden agendas include anything from fixing a faulty light to fixing the roof. You've got this agenda. You've got all this whole list of stuff that he's supposed to do before you're going to be decent. Don't do him like that. Or you've got this, she's got this whole, or he's got this whole list of stuff that you're going to have to do before he's going to really be like you. You've got to have everything completely spotless, Or you just list it, name it. You've got it. Well, that's the hidden agendas we're talking about here. Bartered love, hidden agendas, inability to listen. And that means that all you're doing whenever you pause is you're pausing for breath. And if he happens to get in there with a word or two, you say, yeah. Now, what I was saying, and here you go again, you didn't hear a word that he said, or he didn't hear a word that you said. Inability to listen. The determined repatterning of another's personality. Refusal to express initiative affection. Manipulative behavior and judgmentalism are unproductive devices people use to gain control in the power game of marriage. The question, who's in charge here, is beneath this tug of will. The masochism of human nature is nowhere more vividly dramatized than in our distortion of the one relationship which can give the greatest pleasure and satisfaction, and in our devaluation of the one person who, if loved and affirmed, can give us the greatest ego fortification. What are the internal seeds that you are sowing right now in your marriage, which if it has its end result, your marriage will be destroyed? Unless something happens to stop that trend, you will alienate your wife completely. Your love, that her love for you will completely be smothered, it'll be destroyed, it'll be eradicated. Or the other way around, what are you doing right now that is eroding your marriage? All right, let's look and see what Simon Peter says erodes marriages. If you have your Bibles, turn with me. We're going to be staying for the rest of the time. We're almost We've got to get into this, but it's not detailed, but I want you to turn there to 1 Peter chapter 3, and let's look at it. I want you to have evidence. This is Peter talking, not me. And he gets pretty specific. You know, the Bible doesn't deal much in generalities. It talks pretty specific. Likewise, you wives, be submissive to your husbands. That's chapter 3 of 1 Peter, verse 1. Likewise, you wives, be submissive to your husbands, so that some, though they do not obey the word, may be won without a word by the behavior of their wives when they see your reverent and chaste behavior. Let not yours be the outward adorning with braiding of hair, decoration of gold, wearing of robes, but let it be the hidden person of the heart with the imperishable jewel of a gentle and quiet spirit, which in God's sight is very precious. And that's what he told the wives to do. Look at verse 7 and 8. He tells the husband something to do. Likewise, you husbands, live considerately with your wives, bestowing honor on the woman as the weaker sex, since you are joint heirs of the grace of life, in order that your prayers may not be hindered. Now let's look at it real quickly together. Wives, he tells you to do six things. Now we're going to talk about it in the positive way. Some of these are negative, but we're going to look at it in terms of what happens if you don't do this. We're going to look at it, first of all, just simply positively and define them, and then just dismiss it by saying any woman that ignores this is sowing the seeds of erosion in her marriage. There are six of these, and here they are. Number one, submissiveness. Number two, reverence. Number three, chastity. Number four, modesty. Number five, gentleness. Number six, quietness. Now those are the seven attributes, six attributes that a woman must possess in order for her marriage to be reconstructed, in order for her marriage to flourish. You've got to possess these six qualities. You don't have to possess them perfectly. We're not perfect. But you've got to be working on them. You've got to have these ingredients. It's like having ingredients in a batch of dough. If you leave out the buttermilk, or if you leave out the baking powder, or if you leave out the flour, or leave out the milk, they just ain't going to be much. And these, if you don't have these in your marriage's not going to be much. Or you come out with a blob or something. Oh, yeah, there you go, brother and sister so-and-so. Yeah, they are, two of them, aren't they, in the same car? But the marriage isn't much. It's kind of like cheese and chalk. It's blah. Okay, but if you put these things in there, it's like adding a shot of adrenaline. It's like adding the zest. Boy, and here you go. That's what Peter's trying to get you to see. Number one, submissiveness. Oh. Are you submissive to your husband? Are you in subjection to your husband? Now look, Peter's not trying to make you a slave. That's not what he's after at all. He's talking about this attitude of mind that says, I love you, and I want to be in submission to you as the head of the house. Now, he knows whether or not you're doing it with a gritting teeth and saying, yeah, I'm in submission to you, but I hate you every minute for it. He knows. Your husband knows that. It's like the little girl who was standing up, riding down the street with her daddy in the car, and he said, honey, sit down. It's dangerous standing up in the car. She said, I don't want to sit down. He said, dear, sit down. She jumped out. She let her feet. She didn't just sit. She pulled her feet out from under, you know. She sat down in the chair and bounced, and she said, I may be sitting on the outside, but I'm standing on the inside. Let me tell you, ladies, your husband knows whether you're standing on the inside or not. And that completely, that just destroys what Simon's trying to get you to do. Simon Peter's trying to get you to be of a certain attitude of mind that has gracefully come to the place where you say, you know, somebody's got to head this ship. Somebody's got to direct it. And I'll be first mate. You go ahead and chart the course. I'll be first mate. That's submissiveness to your husband. Well, the second thing he says here, you've got to be reverent. Respectful. You've got to hold your husband in honor. What do you do when you go play 42? You play 42 down here? They do out in Texas. They go 42 crazy. They've even gotten that way. They play 84. Sit around, it's dominoes. They play 42. What do you do when you play whatever? When you get around with a bunch of girls, what do you do about your husband? And what do you cut him down? Do you talk about all his bad points? Do you let them know that you just don't really have much respect for that slob anyway? And you spend all your time together, all of you talking about all the bad things of your husband? You can't do that and be a Christian wife. Uh-uh. You've got to be respectful and reverent of him. And if he's not the kind of man that earns that respect, then listen, men, you've got to earn this respect, really. But until he earns the respect and is the kind of man that you respect because of what he is, you respect him because of where he is. He is the head of your home. That's what his position is. That's what his place of responsibility is. And Bible teaching says that you honor him because of the fact that he is the head of your home. And then he says you're to be chaste. Not C-H-A-S-E-D. C-H-A-S-T-E. Chaste. This talks about your sexual behavior. It talks about your being, it talks about your demeanor. It talks about your being what you would call not provocative. It talks about your being discreet. It forbids raising any flags of availability. You know, there's some wives that raise flags of availability. Yeah. You know what I'm talking about? Some of you women ever raise a flag? You're so cute around other men, you know, and you just flirt. Now, those flags are sometimes are deceptive. You're just a teaser. But be careful. Somebody's liable to take you up on it. This says you're to be chaste. That means you're in your deportment toward other people. You're to know whose wife you are. Are you doing that? Then notice the next thing that he says, he talks about their dress. You know the way that a woman becomes, she comes across more than any other way in of being unchaste, is in her dress. He's not talking here about scantiness. He's not talking here about miniskirts and about short shorts, though that's part of it. That's what he's talking about too, modesty. But when he says, don't let your clothing, don't let your beauty depend upon gold and all this other, he said, don't let it depend on that. Let yours depend on the hidden person of the heart of a meek and quiet spirit. He was referring to the way they used to dress. Man, they used to dress fit to kill back then. If you think we're doing it now, we can't hold a candle to those people. They dress in all these fine clothes, and some of them would just cost thousands and thousands of dollars, and that's the way the society dressed. And they had their hairdos, you know, all wrapped up, and I pronounced that thing right the first hour, coiffure. Is that it, the coiffure? Lay it on me, is that not right? The coiffure, your hairdo. They would interweave gold and put all these things, you know, the diamonds and all the things, and they'd have it where people would just zap, you know, boy, bang. What about that? Whew! And that's the way the women of the world live. The women of the world still live that way. But he said the Christian woman's not supposed to live like that. That's not the way you're supposed to have your beauty derived. Your beauty doesn't derive from that sort of attire. He said you're to be, and then he lists these two, you're to be gentle and of a quiet spirit. Oh, there's nothing more beautiful than a gentle woman. And there's nothing more distasteful than an old, robust, you know, cowpoke of a woman. Here she comes. That's so unbecoming a woman. That's unbecoming a man, really. But it's so... Be a woman. And it comes with gentleness. Sensitive, kind, responsive, gracious. Ah. That, he says, that kind of an attitude in the life of a woman, he says, in the eyes of God, it turns God on. He said, God thinks that's really something. It's of great price in the eyes of God, a woman who is a gentle woman. And then the other one, he says, she must be quiet. Now, that doesn't mean you're supposed to keep your mouth shut and be a wallflower. That's not what it's talking about. The quietness here is the quietness that is associated with a deep running stream. You don't ever hear deep water gurgling. Quiet. Neither will you hear a woman of much quality in all the brashness this is no nagger. This woman won't nag. She won't always be bantering and babbling at home and all this. She's not going to be like that. She's going to have a quiet reservation about her that is purely graceful and genuine and serene. This is the kind of beauty that becomes a woman who professes to be a Christian. Now, you see what he's saying? If you'll do these things, if you'll be submissive to your husband, if you'll be reverent, if you'll be chaste, if you'll be modest, and if you'll let your life be such that you're gentle and you're of a quiet nature, you're building your marriage. And any woman who doesn't do this is sowing seeds of erosion and destructiveness in her marriage. And listen, the thing about it with Christian women is this. After this seminar, at least, I believe we've been specific enough that after this seminar,
You can't do it in ignorance. If you do it after this seminar that we've been in, you're going to do it just simply out of sheer rebellion against the Word of God. That's right. You see, people in the world, their marriages are being just wiped out one after another, time after time, and they go around stumbling. They don't know what's happening. And they say, what in the world am I doing? What have I done wrong now? And on and on. And they don't know. But we as Christians know what it is we're doing. We know what we're doing is wrong. And any refusal to accept what Simon Peter says here and to implement it in our lives between us and our mates is sheer downright rebellion against God that says, I'm going to have my way. I don't care what happens. I'm going to take care of myself. That's what it says. Now, ladies, you've got those six things. Now, let's look at the men a minute. He just gives three for the men. Now, that doesn't mean that the men need less than the women, but he just puts them in three categories. All in verse 7, likewise, you husbands, live considerately with your wives, bestowing honor on the weaker, on the woman as the weaker sex, since you are joint heirs of the grace of life, in order that your prayers may not be hindered. These three injunctions are given to the husbands. These are also attitudes. These are building blocks. These are right down there at the attitudinal level of building blocks. This is what builds up the marriage. And to refuse to do this, you're putting asunder what God joined together. Now look what they are. Live considerately. What does that mean? Well, it means that every thought and action includes her and her well-being. That's all it means. That you don't do anything that doesn't take her and her well-being in mind and keep it in the very forefront of your thinking. That has to do with just anything. The time that you spend at home with your wife and children, do you take her into consideration in that time? Do you take into consideration that she's been home with the children all day and she might need to get out maybe away from the children and just go out for maybe some shopping? Do you give her that freedom to where she feels free to do that? Are you living considerately with her like that? What about money? Are you living considerately with her in regard to money? How would you like, incidentally, to have to go to your wife and ask for an allowance or ask for every time you wanted to buy a handkerchief, a pair of socks? How would you like to have to go up and say, I need a pair of socks? She says, well, okay, but it'll have to be next month. You don't get any more this month. Go on back in there to the dishes. Are you living considerately with her regarding money? We talked about it in the class. I'm getting kind of confused now. Did we mention this in the class? Did we mention in the class about money and how... Yeah, that was in the class where I trust her with everything. You know, it's her money too. It's a joint thing. She has as much access to every penny I've got. She writes as many checks. She has the same charge cards. She has the whole blooming scene because I trust her. And she knows it. And she's as proud of things that she buys. She says, come in, let me show you what I found. And boy, I go in there, and if she starts laying out all that stuff, it just tickles me to death. She's no more scared of that. And it may have charged up $50, but boy, I know her after 24 years. She'll pinch a penny until the buffalo squeals. Yes, sir. She'll drive halfway across town and spend a quarter on gas to save a dime on a can of beans. And she says, you men, you know, this suit, let's see, yeah, this tie. We went down to the dollar store. That's a beauty. That's a beauty. It cost about $2. Ties at the other place where I usually shop cost $8 and $10. She says, you men don't know how to shop. She says, you just go in there and say, yeah, I'll take that and charge that. And she says, I've been telling you, if you'll go to the dollar store with me, and we did, and I found a shirt for $3.95. I've been paying $18, you know. I won't pay many 18s, but they're selling for $18 down yonder. No, I trust her, man, a lot. But you got to live considerately with her. Let's look at something else real quickly. You've got to live considerately with her when it comes to affections. And so many, just be considerate of her. Don't do anything that you don't find yourself saying, how is this going to affect my wife? Oh, it's so important. And it's not to be done just at those times when you want to get something out of her. You know what I mean. Is that the only time that you're considerate of your wife? Oh, hello, honey. Or you bring her a box of candy. Hi, baby.
It's good to see you.
I'm so glad to see you. And you know all along what it's for? She knows. Man, she's no idiot. She's smart as a whip. She knows you're setting her up. Yeah. And it's a game, kind of, that if you understand, you play it, and that's, you know, play the game. I court my wife, man. She knows that the end result is it's finally going in. You know, I'm after something. I love her, and I love her all the time, but don't do like a cardinal does. Did you ever see a cardinal eat with his wife? People who have feeders, they feed them these sunflower seeds. And they tell me, and a woman over in Searcy told me that they've got one of these feeders, and the cardinals, she says, they just flock to it. And the male cardinal, he just screams at his wife, you know, and tells her to get out of here, and he just scratches and just flaps his wing. He won't let her come up there and get something to eat. If she eats, she has to eat when he's not there. When he's there, buddy, she better get out of the way. That's exactly the way they eat until, guess when? Until it's mating season. And then the little scrappers, you know what he does? This woman said he goes up to the feeder, gets that sunflower seed. Not only does he get one, he cracks it open for her and gets it in her bill and takes it over and feeds her. The little hypocrite. Isn't that considerate? Oh, how sweet. Isn't that considerate of that little cardinal? It doesn't come across like that. And when that's the only way you're considerate, Buster, you don't come across like that either. You're just like this stupid cardinal. He doesn't have any more sense than to do that. You do. You're a Christian. Live considerately with your wife. Well, but he says next, live protectively with her. He said, give honor to her as the weaker sex. Ladies, did you know you're the weaker sex? Now, that has me taken with some qualification. Weaker sex, that's right. And yet you are that. You're not brawny. You don't have the muscle. You don't have many things that a man has. You're the weaker sex. He says you need to be aware of that. And you need to give her that honor. In other words, you need to be aware of the fact that she has hurts and aches and needs that you don't have. And the fact that you can go out and work all day and, you know, and you're just going strong and you're robust and you're healthy and here you go and you can't understand why in the world she's sick. What's the matter with you anyway? Well, she's the weaker sex. Yeah. Now, that's true only until the man himself gets sick and Katie bar the door. There ain't nobody that can grumble and groan like a man when he's sick. Oh, honey, I'm dying. My wife, really, my wife, she says you can groan more when you're sick than any human I have ever seen. But she's right there waiting on me night and day, you know. But the man, in so many respects, is the stronger. But you know what it's like? It's like the eye and the fist. Which is the weaker member of your body, the eye or the fist? Well, the eye is. It's the more tender, it's the more sensitive. And the fist can't understand a lot of things that the eye hurts over. A grain of sand in the eye, man, that hurts. But wouldn't you think it's stupid for a man to say, well, that's the silliest thing I ever heard of. I don't hurt, and the fist, you know, just pounds on that sand. He says, look at that, I can do that. That doesn't hurt me at all. What's the matter with you? Just go on, get that sand. Don't worry about it. A man that's in his right mind will say to his wife, I don't understand, but I accept that. I can't understand why you're hurting, but if you say you're hurting, dear, I know you're hurting. And if you're sick, I'm going to let you enjoy being sick. I'm going to let you enjoy it. And I'm going to do everything in my power to see to it that you get what you need. Now, any man in his right mind does that. A man that's not in his right mind won't do that. But now Paul says in Ephesians that no man ever hated his own flesh. How do you treat yourselves, men, when you're sick? Well, look at yourself real close now. When you're sick, you want it to be known, and you want to have the time to enjoy being miserable. Sure you do.
Well, that's what he says. That's the way a man treats his body. He says no man in his right mind ever abuses his own flesh. You don't ever see a man standing around hitting himself in the head.
Things I think he thought that was getting to her was the fact that they weren't making enough money for her to live without living under a strain. She felt constantly under a strain, a financial strain. So he decided he'd go away and get a doctor's degree so he could up his salary. He asked her, he said, do you think that you think you could stand it if we went, if we moved for a couple of years? You think you could stand that? You think you feel up to it? She thought about it and she said, yeah, I think so. I believe we can make it. And after consultation with her, they packed up and he resigned his job. They rented their house out. They packed up all their belongings in a U-Haul truck and they drove all the way to Texas. And they backed up to the house that he had found. They began unloading all that furniture and everything. And when they got down to the last piece, she broke down in tears and said, I'm just not going to be able to do it. I'm here to tell you that that man just told her, he said, well, that's all right. Don't you worry about it. And that man of God started hauling all that stuff and putting it back into the truck, packed every stick of it again, left and took off back to Searcy. His job was gone. He started doing janitorial work, mopping floors, cleaning out urinals. You know why? Because his wife couldn't stand the pressure. And he just simply said, well, that's all right. We'll do something else. Now, gentlemen, that is a man. And he stood before me in my office and explained why he was back there. He didn't blame her. He just simply said, we'll make it some way. But what about the expense? And he could have, what about all that expense you've been at? That didn't make any difference. She's more important than money. Good Lord. A wife is more important than money. What difference does it make? But what about your job? He said, well, the Lord will provide. We'll get another job. And I saw him take that woman and scratch her where she itched and heal her where she hurted. I saw her help her where she needed support. I saw him encourage her where she needed encouragement. I saw him do all these things to this one who was his own body and flesh and bone. And boy, I have never seen an example of it so beautiful as I saw in that man's life. Now that's really manhood. He was living considerately of his wife in consideration of her as the weaker sex. Well, I don't know what else to say about it except that's where it's at. And men, if you're not living like that in your family, you are guilty of sowing seeds of discord and dissolution and absolute erosion in your marriage. Then finally he said, live jointly with her. He said, give her honor, because he said, she's a joint heir with you of the gift of life. That's not just talking about eternal life. He's talking about now. She's got as much right to live and enjoy life right now as you've got. That's right. She's a partner. She's not your employee. You're not her employer.
She's your partner in this, and she's got as much right to enjoy life and to have herself as an individual. She's got just as much right as I've got. Live jointly with her. The word here, the prefix, is the word soon, the Greek word soon. It's a prefix that means together. We get our word symphony. It's the sound of music together or vibrating together. It's the word sympathy, which means to suffer with, together with. That's what he's saying. She's your joint heir. She's got as much right to be enjoying life, and she's in as much a part of life as you are. That's what he's saying. You see what I'm talking about when I say that Simon Peter gets down to the nitty-gritty. He says, you live considerately with your wife. You live protectively of your wife. And you live as though she's a joint heir with you of this life and the life to come. You are today either nearer together in your marriage or you're farther apart. Now, you'll know whether you are, which you are. If you're farther apart, then your marriage is eroding. I don't know how long it'll take before it'll fall apart completely. If you're nearer together, then it means that you're daily rebuilding your marriage. But ladies, if you choose to disregard Simon Peter's instruction of your being submissive to your husband, of giving him honor as a husband, of being chaste, of being modest, of being gentle and quiet, if you're disregarding that, you're in opposition to the will of God. Men, if you're living in opposition to Simon Peter's recommendation or his instructions that you live considerately with your wife, that you live protectively with your wife, that you live jointly with your wife, not only are you endangering your marriage, you're endangering your soul's salvation. Simon Peter says to live in disregard of this is to put your prayers in jeopardy. He says you live with her so that your prayers won't be hindered. Like I told him at the first service, if you don't live like this, if you live irrespective and disregarding her, you don't live considerately with her, you don't live protectively of her, and you don't live like she's got the sense too and that she has a right to enjoy life too. If you don't live with her like that, and you then decide you're going to say, let us pray, I said, I believe I'd recommend you pray with one eye open. She's liable to put a skillet across your skull. Yeah, your prayers will indeed be hindered. They'll be cut real short. Whack. And you deserve it. All right. You're either nearer together or you're farther apart. You're not at the same point where you were when you married. You're either growing farther apart or you're growing together. May God bless us. We've got too much at stake here to ignore it. And we've got too much going for us here to be blind. We're not blind. The only thing standing between you and your marriage, you know what it is? It's you. Wives, it's you. Husbands, it's you. It's us. The day that you lay your life down before your wife, before your husband, the day you lay your life down before each other, that's the day that your marriage will be resurrected. And it won't come until then. May God bless us. Let's be at it. We've got too much at stake and too much ahead of us that's wonderful and glorious if we'll just listen to what the Lord says and put the mind of Christ into work in our marriages.